session with a different panel. Chief Justice Livingston has joined us. And if the lawyers are ready, we're ready to go forward with Lozano versus State.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Gary Udishin. I represent Mr. Lozano. I'm going to primarily talk about the sufficiency of the evidence and also spend a few minutes talking about the dismissal motion that had been filed by the previous district attorney in this case. Let me start on the sufficiency argument with a few comments about Brooks versus State. As the court's aware, we raised a factual sufficiency argument, but now that the Court of Criminal Appeals has done away with that standard of review in Brooks, it changes the analysis of that issue, but I would also submit that it changes the analysis of the legal sufficiency issue. And in particular, I want to point the court to a couple of comments in the different opinions in Brooks. First of all, in the plurality opinion in Brooks, which I believe was written by Judge Hervey, she said that they remanded that case back to the Court of Appeals for consideration of the legal sufficiency argument that had been previously rejected. And I believe that the plurality opinion is the opinion that said that they were doing that because of the what they characterize as the confusing standards of review between factual and legal sufficiency may have skewed a rigorous application of Jackson versus Virginia on the legal sufficiency. And then in Judge Cochran's concurring opinion, she discussed Jackson versus Virginia and pointed out that was not a no evidence standard of review. And I think the gist of her discussion of Jackson was to also emphasize that perhaps the courts of appeals had not been rigorously enough applying Jackson on legal sufficiency. So the point I'm making by pointing to those two opinions is that I believe that the silver lining from a defense standpoint in Brooks is that I read that as an invitation to courts of appeals to perhaps apply a Jackson standard more strenuously than had been done in the past. And so I think this is certainly the kind of case where that would be appropriate. This case, as the court's aware, is a murder case where Mr. Lozano was accused of murdering his wife. There are certainly no eyewitnesses. There's no physical evidence. There's no sort of direct evidence at all that ties him to an alleged murder. It's significant that the medical examiner, Tarrant County Medical Examiner, Dr. Sisler, who testified, and his testimony also was that this was concurred in by Dr. Perwani, and so the medical examiner's office concluded that this was an undetermined cause of death, meaning that it could be homicide, could be suicide, or it could be accident. So you begin with a lack of evidence that this was even a homicide from the medical examiner. There are essentially two primary arguments that the state makes and made at trial and make on appeal to try to convince the court and convince the jury that the evidence was sufficient. Number one, they try to prove that Mr. Lozano was at the scene at the time that his wife was killed. That's number one. And then number two, they make an argument that the scene was staged in some way to make it appear to be an accident or a suicide. Now, if the state's evidence falls short of what is sufficient to prove either one of those two things, then the evidence is going to be legally insufficient under Jackson. Now, let me talk first of all about the question about whether they proved that Mr. Lozano was at the scene at the time that his wife was killed. This really comes down to this lividity question. Now, the state's witnesses, and we're talking primarily police detectives and paramedics, testified concerning lividity, that they observed lividity in Mrs. Lozano's body at the time they responded to the scene. And lividity is essentially the pooling of blood that begins after the death of a person. And so the argument that they were making was that lividity wouldn't begin until, some of them said 30 minutes to 45 minutes. Some of them said, we're talking about from the time of death to the beginning of lividity. Some said 30 to 45 minutes. Some said 30 minutes to an hour. Some said more than an hour. The point that the state was making by presenting that testimony was that that Mr. Lozano would have been with Mrs. Lozano at home according to what he said had happened that night at the time that she died. What Mr. Lozano said in his written statement and what he told the police was that he was home with his wife. He had gone to a tanning salon, drove about 10 minutes from his house to the tanning salon, did a 20-minute tanning session, and then drove the 10 minutes back to his home. So there's about, 40 minutes there. There was whatever time period it took him to check in and out of the tanning salon, and then get in and out of his car, and then he arrived home, and he saw his wife had been shot, called 911, and then there's an additional period of time waiting for 911 to arrive. And so at the very minimum, it's certainly much more than 30 minutes, that time frame, and probably more closer to an hour even in that time frame, according to the testimony presented. But the state's argument was that he would have had to be home with his wife when she was killed, because lividity had set in at some point that would put him home, according to his own story. The problem with that is that the only medical testimony concerning the onset of lividity came from Dr. Sisler, the medical examiner from Tarrant County, who testified that lividity can begin is in 20 to 30 minutes. So under Dr. Sisler's testimony, and of course Dr. Sisler is a state's witness, the state's theory that Mr. Lozano was home with his wife at the time of her death, it just doesn't hold up according to Dr. Sisler's testimony, and even according to some of the estimates of the time frame given by some of the other state's witnesses.
So is the testimony of the other state witnesses, like the police officers and I think some other persons that arrived on scene, should the jury just have ignored that evidence?
Your Honor, I don't know that ignored would be the right word, but in a sufficiency of the evidence analysis, when you have a state's witness who is a medical doctor, who is an expert, that says something contrary to what a police officer says, then I think it's an unreasonable conclusion for a jury to go with the police officer rather than the medical examiner. And so from a sufficiency analysis, I think that's exactly what the Court of Criminal Appeals was talking about, a rigorous analysis, not just accepting something and saying that this is good enough. And that's a perfect example, is that it is unreasonable for a jury to go with a police officer over Dr. Sisler under these circumstances. But I would emphasize that some of the estimates given by the lay witnesses, I mean the non-medical witnesses, would still make the evidence insufficient in this particular situation. The other major question on the sufficiency is whether or not there was evidence that the scene was staged. And the state's primary argument on whether the scene was staged is a claim that a shell casing was found under the gun cleaning kit. Now, what the circumstances were was that Mr. Lozano said that he had gotten his gun. Mr. Lozano, as you know, was a police officer, that he had gotten his gun cleaning kit out and spread it out on his and his wife's bed before he went to the tanning salon. And the state argued that a shell casing was found under the gun cleaning kit. The problem with that argument is that there is a drawing by a police detective of where everything was found that showed the shell casing was not under the gun cleaning kit, but was somewhere above the gun cleaning kit on the bed.
What do they mean by that, above the bed? I have trouble with that.
Well, Your Honor, I did too a little bit, but I believe what they mean by that is that it's lying on the bed above where the gun cleaning kit is sitting. So, like somewhere on the bed above the gun cleaning kit is the way I understand that. In addition to that, none of the police reports, the record shows that none of the police reports that were prepared by any of the officers indicated that the shell casing was found under the gun cleaning kit. The other issue that sort of plays into that is whether or not the body was moved at any time during this process while the police investigators were doing this investigation at the scene. And there was a conflict where in the testimony, whereas I believe it was one paramedic and one police officer said they observed two of Mr. Lozano's wife's legs off of the bed, and other officers said that they just observed one leg off the bed, which would indicate her body had been moved. One officer said that there were some little dogs that were jumping on the bed and licking her body. There was some indication that the paramedics had actually moved the body, but the state's witnesses and the state argued, because it's necessary to their argument about the stage being seen, the scene being staged, that there was nothing moved, whereas the evidence from the state's own witnesses clearly shows that that's incorrect. And I believe that there was at least one detective that admitted that if the body had been moved or items had been moved, then their entire theory about this scene being staged would not be accurate. So essentially what you have on the sufficiency of the evidence is if the lividity doesn't set in, if there's in the manner and in the time frame that the state argued, then the evidence is insufficient to show that Mr. Lozano was at the scene of the time of the death. If the body was moved or if other items were moved, which apparently they were, then the state's theory that the scene was staged doesn't hold up under scrutiny. So under those circumstances, the evidence is legally insufficient, in addition to what we said, factually insufficient, but under a rigorous application of Jackson versus Virginia, this would be a legal insufficiency case. Let me make just a couple of comments about the history of the case and the yes.
Before you leave the issue about the body being moved, as I read the brief and your brief, in addition to the state's, Lozano testified that when he came back to the home and found her shot, that he moved her and put her on the floor and attempted to deal with CPR.
Your Honor, I think there's some confusion. And I think there's some contradictory things that Mr. Lozano said in the heat of the passion of the moment as to whether or not he had attempted CPR with her on the bed or whether he'd moved her to the ground. I think that his statement that he had attempted CPR with her on the bed is more consistent with, which is what he said at one point, is more consistent with what the evidence showed.
Yes, that's
correct, Your Honor. That is correct. Real briefly, when Bruce Isaacs was the district attorney of Denton County, this case began in 2002. He was the district attorney prosecuting the case. The district attorney's office had hired the chief medical examiner of Cook County, Illinois, to review the autopsy in this case. And according to Mr. Isaacs, the chief medical examiner, who is named Dr. Donahue, had sent him a report saying it was his conclusion that this was suicide. And based upon that, Mr. Isaacs dismissed this case. He filed a motion to dismiss this case, wrote in his dismissal motion what I just said about Dr. Donahue. When this came back to trial, being tried under a new DA, the defense attempted to introduce into evidence that dismissal motion. And the argument essentially would be that under 803.8C, that is Mr. Isaac's dismissal motion is admissible because it's factual findings made by somebody authorized to investigate something and reach a factual conclusion. His factual conclusion was that this was suicide based upon his investigation. The trial court refused to admit this dismissal motion, and I think the primary reason, as the trial court stated and the state argues in their brief, was the trial court found that it was not reliable, which is an exception to the rule. And the only thing I'll say, because I know my time is up, is that it seems somewhat dangerous to conclude that a statement by the sitting district attorney who was in charge at the time is not reliable, because obviously there are thousands of prosecutions that occurred when he was the district attorney. Thank you.
Let me clarify one thing. Did the motion itself recite his reliance upon this Illinois ME's medical opinion?
It did, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, there was a bill of exception, and Mr. Isaacs was called to testify as part of the bill of exception.
Okay. Thank you. Have that.
You have that, yes, Your Honor.
May it please the court. I'm Charlie Orbison. I represent the Denton County in this case, the state. Mr. Unishin has done what appellants are often forced to do, and that's what the Court of Criminal Appeals says in Clayton is the divide and conquer approach to dealing with sufficiency of the evidence when the evidence is so stacked against you and the cumulative force of the evidence led but only one rational jury conclusion in this case, and that was that Bobby Lozano was guilty of murdering his wife. So Mr. Unishin then seizes upon two pieces of evidence and bases his entire sufficiency argument upon those. But as this court knows from reading the state's brief, there were dozens of pieces of evidence, the cumulative force of which led to one rational conclusion by the jury. In the reply brief that appellant files, he said there was, and he said it again to you today, there's no physical evidence. I count 13 pieces of physical evidence that the state admitted. They're all discussed in the state's brief. I won't go through each one of them with you today, relying on the court to do a fair reading of the two parties' positions in the briefing. I would, though, as I reviewed my brief in preparation for argument today, I did notice that perhaps I did not clearly explain one of those pieces of physical evidence that the appellant says we did not have. That was the popcorn. There was a lot of evidence about the popcorn at trial, but perhaps I didn't make it as clear as I should have in my brief that part of the popcorn was found inside the pajamas of Vicky Lozano. Loosely inside the pajamas, because perhaps the court would think, well, she could have. Also, there was no popcorn bowl or popcorn bag in the bedroom, so maybe the court would have thought, well, she returned that to the kitchen or wherever before coming back to bed. But the loose popcorn in her pajamas, there was testimony that would have fallen out had she walked any distance whatsoever. Therefore, the fact that there was no popcorn bowl and bag inside the bedroom with her, the fact that popcorn inside her pajamas would have fallen out had she returned a popcorn bowl or bag to the kitchen or anywhere else in the house, certainly was one of the pieces of evidence that showed investigators that the scene was staged. It was not one piece of evidence that led to that conclusion. The record contains dozens of pages of testimony in which investigators and police officers indicated their reasons why their belief that the scene was staged. Although it helps appellant to reduce it to one piece of evidence, it certainly is not in the case. As we all know, in a legal sufficiency review of the evidence, we don't do a divide and conquer approach. The Court of Criminal Appeals told us we don't do that. In Clayton, in Hooper, in Guevara, in a number of cases. What we do, one piece of evidence, it is possible for the evidence to be legally sufficient, even though not any single piece of evidence points to guilt standing alone. But it's the cumulative force of the evidence. And here there's just a mountain of evidence. Yes, it's circumstantial. It wouldn't surprise anyone that a police detective, if he was going to murder his wife, would not do so in front of an eyewitness. The evidence is circumstantial. It's strongly circumstantial. And the jury's verdict in this case was anything but irrational. Without getting into detailed discussions of evidence, I think that's what all I'll say on the sufficiency point, unless this court has any questions or is concerned about anything that Mr. Uderson might have said. Let's go on then to the second issue that the appellant argued today. First of all, it's possible for anyone, including myself, including this court, including Mr. Uderson, to make a bad decision. We've all made them. The fact that we make a bad decision every once in a while doesn't cast aspersions on all the decisions that we're going to make for the rest of our lives. So his argument that we can't trust any Denton County convictions if we can't trust this motion to dismiss in the Lozano case is simply not logically or true or accurate. If you look at the offer of the evidence made at trial and the careful and thoughtful attention that the trial court gave to it in terms of analyzing what was being offered and how it was being offered, it is clear that the trial court did not abuse its discretion in not admitting that motion to dismiss. It was indeed offered, as Mr. Uderson says, under 8038C. Part of that rule, as this court knows upon the briefing, is that this evidence should not be admitted under that rule if there are circumstances that indicate a lack of trustworthiness. Here, all of the factual assertions contained in the motion were untrustworthy, provably untrustworthy, demonstrably untrustworthy. First, the motion said that Dr. Sisler had changed his mind. He was the medical examiner. Dr. Sisler testified he has never changed his mind. So we know that's not a fact. The trial court said that's probably an opinion, more than a fact. But even if it is a fact, it's certainly not a trustworthy fact, because we had the testimony of Dr. Sisler. Secondly, it said that the chief medical examiner from Cook County had written a report and that had concluded it was likely a suicide. The cross-examination of Dr. Sisler by appellant proved that was not true. Again, if it was a factual assertion, it was notoriously untrustworthy. And the state looks at the final basis for the trial court's ruling as well in its briefing, and I won't belabor the point today. Clearly, the evidence was not trustworthy. The evidence, the dismissal motion itself, perhaps came from misinformation that the district attorney had. Perhaps it came from, we don't know. Record doesn't really indicate, just indicates the untrustworthiness of it. It may have come from a lead prosecutor who wasn't excited about trying the case and who colored everything he or she may have heard. We don't know. But the motion was not trustworthy evidence. So, secondly, the appellant wanted to admit just the testimony of the former district attorney. Even though he had already testified in bill of exception, that what he knew he got from a report that he allegedly had read. And the trial court was justifiably wary that such a report ever existed. And as the state points out in the brief, it conclusively established that there was never a report. So clearly there was no testimony to be offered by the former district attorney because he said what he learned came from a report and the report never existed. It was clearly the right decision. One final point I forgot to make, jumping back to sufficiency of the evidence for a second, is the lividity question that appellant is preoccupied with. First of all, lividity testimony in this case showed a couple of things. Coming from experienced paramedics and police officers, the first two responders who responded within 4 minutes of the dispatch call said this lady had been dead for at least an hour. Not only lividity, but there was no, I think the way the prosecutor asked the question, was there anything that showed she was freshly dead? And the paramedic said no. There was not even an attempt at CPR by the paramedics because it was obvious she had been dead for quite a while. And both of these experienced paramedics said that the lividity they saw showed that she had been dead for at least an hour. Jury heard that. It was not an irrational decision to believe that. But something else the lividity showed that appellant does not discuss is that the lividity showed that Mr. Lozano lied in his statement. His statement was that the body was kind of sitting up, face down in a dependent position, and that when he touched his wife and she fell over, as Judge, you were talking about, and she fell back. And that was roughly 4 minutes before the paramedics walked into the room. And what did they find? No lividity in the face, where there should have been, if she was hanging like that, and they found lividity in her back, where it would not have been in 4 minutes. So lividity here showed several things. And sure, there's the medical examiner did testify, as most people, medical people, that lividity can begin 20 to 30 minutes, but it can also can begin up to 2 hours. That's his testimony. State's not disputing that. Everybody knows that. These experienced paramedics had seen lividity on a number of occasions, and the lividity they saw, although they're not medical people, was that the death had occurred at least an hour previous. Why did he go to the tanning salon at all? Obviously to manufacture an alibi. He had never tanned 2 days in a row that entire summer. He had tanned the day before, and now he's going back to the tanning salon. The jury had to ask themselves why. There is so much evidence, there's no way to actually address it all in oral argument. If there are any questions about either of the issues that appellant has addressed today, I'd be happy to deal with them. But without that, the state would simply encourage the court to read the record as, of course, as it will, and to read the briefing and affirm the judgment. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly on the sufficiency question, what I'm asking the court to do is to look at all of these little pieces of what the state contends put together established sufficient evidence, and in particular, I'm using the lividity as an example. If the state's argument on lividity is not supported by the evidence, then they don't have any evidence to show that Mr. Lozano was at the scene of the time of death. Their evidence, each one of these circumstances put together, don't establish the evidence to be sufficient. But in particular, when you take some of these major ones out, like the lividity and like the staging of the scene and like where was the shell casing found, their entire theory falls apart. They need each one of these things to be supported by the evidence to make their argument. And several of these, as we point out in our brief and as I point out here on oral argument, are not supported by the evidence, so the evidence is insufficient. Excuse me. On the question concerning Mr. Isaacs and the dismissal motion, What the state is arguing is the type of argument and the type of evidence that perhaps they could have submitted to the jury after this evidence was submitted. This is really a question of whether or not the trial court acted properly in refusing to admit the evidence. And so again, I go back to the same issue, is that the trial court's ruling was that Mr. Isaac's testimony and Mr. Isaac's motion for dismissal that he wrote, where he said he had received a report and read a report from the Cook County Medical Examiner saying he believed it was suicide, the trial court is finding that to not be trustworthy. So the trial court's finding Mr. Isaac's to not be trustworthy. And I would submit that that was an abuse of discretion and an unreasonable ruling and an unreasonable basis to keep this evidence away from the jury. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Whenever I'm fully finished reading this record, mm-hmm. What evidence is there in the record that there was never a report from Dr. Donovan?
There is statements from district attorneys who were trying the case at the time that there was no report in their file. I believe at the we had a new motion for new trial hearing. I believe that the state produced an affidavit from the prosecutor who was in charge of the actual assistant district attorney in charge of the prosecution under Mr. Isaacs that he had never seen a report. And I believe that the defense attorney said off, you know, in a conference with the judge on the record discussing this issue that he had spoken to Dr. Donahue, and Dr. Donahue said he didn't recall whether he wrote a report.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your briefing and good arguments. We appreciate it.